attempts are miserable, violent affairs, and can involve breaking the ribs of elderly patients who would be better left to die in peace. So I became hardened in the way that doctors have to become hardened, and came to see patients as an entirely separate race from all important, invulnerable young doctors like myself. Now that I am reaching the end of my career, this detachment has started to fade. I am less frightened by the failure. I have come to accept it and feel less threatened by it, and hopefully have learned from the mistakes I made in the past. I can dare to be a little less detached. Besides, with advancing age, I can no longer deny that I am made of the same flesh and blood as my patients, and that I am equally vulnerable. So I now feel a deeper pity for them than in the past. I know that I, too, sooner or later, will be stuck like them in a bed, in a crowded hospital bay, fearing for my life. After finishing my year as a houseman, I returned to my teaching hospital in North London to work as a senior house officer on the intensive care unit. I had decided, with diminishing conviction, to try to train as a surgeon, and working in intensive care was seen as a useful first step. The job mainly involved filling up forms, putting up drips, taking blood, and occasionally more exciting invasive procedures, as they are called, such as inserting chest drains or IVs into the large veins of the neck. All the practical instruction was given by the more experienced junior doctors. It was while working on the ITU that I had gone down to the operating theatres and seen the aneurysm operation that prompted my surgical epiphany. Now that I knew exactly what I wanted to do, my life became much easier. A few days later, I went to find the neurosurgeon I had watched clipping the aneurysm and told him I wanted to become a neurosurgeon. He told me to apply for the neurosurgical SHO job in his department, which was shortly to be advertised. I also spoke to one of the senior general surgeons, on whose firm I had been as a student. An exceptionally kind man, the kind of surgical teacher I came close to worshipping, he immediately arranged for me to go and see two of the most senior neurosurgeons in the country, both to make myself known as a would-be brain surgeon and to plan my career. Neurosurgery was a small world in those years, with fewer than 100 consultants in all of the UK. One of the senior surgeons I went to see was at the Royal London in the East End. A very affable man. I found him in his office smoking a cigar. The walls were lined with photographs of Formula One racing cars, since he was, I learned, the doctor for Formula One racing. I told him of my deep desire to be a neurosurgeon. "What does your wife think about it?" was his first question. "I think she thinks it's a good idea, sir," I said. "Well, my first wife couldn't stand a life, so I changed her for a different model," he replied. "It's a hard life, you know, training in neurosurgery." A few weeks later, I drove down to Southampton to see another senior neurosurgeon. He was equally friendly, balding with red hair and a moustache. He looked more like a jovial farmer than what I expected a neurosurgeon to look like. He sat at a desk covered in piles of patients' notes that almost hid him from view. I told him about my ambition to become a neurosurgeon. "What's your wife think about it?" he asked. I assured him that all would be well. He said nothing for a while. "The operating's the easy part, you know," he said. "By my age, you realise that the difficulties are all to do with the decision-making." Chapter 7. Meningioma. Noun. A benign tumour arising from the fibrous covering of the brain and spinal cord. Usually slow-growing, produces symptoms by pressure on the underlying nervous tissue. On Monday morning, I had awoken at 7 to the sound of heavy rain. It was February, and the sky, seen dimly through my bedroom windows, was the colour of lead. There was a long operating list ahead of me, but I doubted if I would be able to finish it, since I knew that the hospital was overflowing once again, and that there was a shortage of beds. The day would end with the misery of my having to apologise to at least one patient who would have been kept waiting all day, nil by mouth, starved and anxious, on the off chance that a post-operative bed might become available, to be told that their operation would have to be postponed. So, cursing the weather with the wind and rain against me, and cursing the hospital's bed state, I cycled to work. I was late for the morning meeting, and sat down next to one of my colleagues, a neuroradiologist whose interpretation of brain scans, a very difficult skill, is second to none, and on whose advice I depend to save me from making mistakes. I asked Anthony, the registrar who had been on call for emergency admissions overnight, to present the admissions. He was sitting at the computer at the front of the room and had been waiting for me to arrive. Anthony was quite junior and tended to be a bit gung-ho, not an unusual characteristic in a surgeon, but one which most neurosurgeons lose as they become more experienced. "There was nothing very interesting last night," he replied. I looked at him and irritably told him that the simple everyday problems were often the most important ones. He looked hurt by my criticism, and I momentarily regretted my bad manners. "This is a 96-year-old woman who has been living independently and has been starting to fall at home," he said. "She's got severe aortic stenosis. You can hear the cardiac murmur from the end of the bed. She's got a left hemiparesis and can't walk but is fully orientated." I asked one of the most junior doctors sitting in the front row for the most likely diagnosis. "The only condition we might treat in somebody that age would be a chronic subdural," he replied confidently. I asked him about the significance of the aortic stenosis. "It means that a general anaesthetic would probably kill her." I told Anthony to show us the scan. He turned to the computer keyboard. He typed in a number of passwords, but it took several minutes before the website, linking us to the local hospitals, from where most of our patients come, appeared. While he fiddled with the computer, the other junior doctors laughed and joked about the hospital's IT systems, while trying to help him locate the patient's scans. "The software for transferring scans is complete crap. Try refreshing, Anthony. No, go to view, then tile. Doesn't seem to be working. Drag it over to the left. It's useless. Try going back to login." Eventually, the old woman's brain scan suddenly flashed up on the wall in front of us. It showed a thick layer of fluid between the inside of her skull and the surface of her brain, distorting the right cerebral hemisphere. It was yet another old person with a chronic subdural, the commonest emergency in neurosurgery. The rest of the brain didn't look too bad for her age, and much less shrunken than for most 96-year-olds. "My father died at that age with Alzheimer's," I said to the trainees. "His brain, on his brain scan, looked like a Swiss cheese plant. There was so little left." "So, Anthony," I continued, "what's the problem?" "It's an ethical problem. She says she would rather die than have to leave her home and end up in a nursing home." "Well, that's not unreasonable. Have you ever worked on a psychogeriatric ward or nursing home?" "No," he replied. I started to talk about how I had once worked as a psychogeriatric nursing assistant. Looking after a ward of 26 doubly incontinent old men was not easy. As the population gets older and older, there are going to be more and more scandals in the media about abuse in old people's homes. By 2050, a third of the population of Europe will be over 60. My first boss in general surgery, a lovely man, ended his days in a nursing home because of dementia. His daughter told me he kept on saying that he wanted to die, but he was terribly fit, and it took ages. He used to have a cold bath every morning when he was younger. "Well, we can't just let her die," one of the registrars in the back row said, interrupting my monologue. "Why not?" I said.